Hello and welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
How you doing tonight, Sean?
I'm good. I'm a bit overworked, but ultimately, I'm super as always.
We're four episodes in to our series, The Good, The Bad, and The Crazy, and I have to say, Sean, we're in a bit of a quagmire, aren't we?
We're in a quicksand of professionalism.
Well, it's funny. We're both working quite a lot these days, but it's our own damn fault, Sean, because in addition to, I mean, there's fireworks going off outside, it's bonfired out while we're recording this, we're working nonstop, we're watching films for the podcast, and then, in the only spare moments that we have, we're obsessed with a 10-hour, incredibly depressing historical documentary.
Yeah, so it's the PBS Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, amazing, stunning Vietnam War documentary. And I think we're five episodes in, and we've got about 10 hours more to go, and I cannot get enough. Like, it will be 1:45 in the morning, and my eyes will be, like, droopier than usual, and I'll say, can we just watch one more, please?
What's going on in Saigon? We have to know.
I need to know what's happening.
Who's going to win the election of 1968? You know, basically, we are not sleeping, ladies and gentlemen. It is a constant stream of media consumption and media commentary here at Broad Appeal HQ. I should also say, Sean, I have been doing a bit of admin work to get us onto even more podcasting platforms, not just Stitcher and Apple Podcasts, but also various things you probably never even heard of, like Podbean.
I've heard of that.
Acast.
Nope.
That sounds like some sort of like mortgage lending tool or something like that. So we are now trying to disseminate this podcast even more widely. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm just going to ask you to do one thing for us to help make this happen. Please leave us a rating or a review. I have to admit, like, Apple Podcasts does not make it very easy to figure out how to do this. But if you have updated your iOS system, all you got to do is, like, you got to go on to the little page that has Broad Appeal and just scroll down to the bottom. Just scroll down to the bottom, and there's lots of stars. Give us as many stars as you want, but, you know, five's a good number.
Yeah, and if you're listening to this on your phone right now, just do it now.
Yeah, take a pause, scroll down, leave us five stars, write something nice, because it really does help people discover the podcast. Thanks very much.
See, now that part is done.
The begging is done.
Let's talk about the movies.
Let's talk about a woman who doesn't have to beg for anything.
Yeah, because her love don't cost a thing.
That's right. So don't be fooled. Don't be fooled
by the rocks that she has, because I believe in good grammar.
We may be five stars, but she is definitely on the six. So
that's very good.
Thanks, Johnny. I have to say, like, of all the people we have ever covered on Broad Appeal, we have conformed to stereotype in many, many instances. And yet, we decided not to do Tilda Swinton. We decided not to do Sandra Bernhard. We have done probably one of the most out-of-left-field choices of an actress yet in our 43 episodes.
And that's only because you wouldn't necessarily associate her with us.
Yeah, we're talking about Jennifer Lopez, who is not just an actress and a movie star, but a musical phenomenon, a
entrepreneur.
Yeah, basically a lifestyle brand, as far as I can tell.
She was the first celebrity perfume that I became aware of, even though, of course, Liz Taylor had been doing it for decades.
White Diamonds.
White Diamonds. Actually, Blue Sapphires, that was the perfume that we had in my father's shed. I told you this before, didn't I?
It's been featured in podcast before. Yeah.
Did I tell you the memory? Let's say it again. I remember saying to my mother, I was like, did you know Elizabeth Taylor had perfume? And she was like, yes. In fact, I think there's one in your father's shed. Let's go get it now.
I love it when we recount anecdotes in the exact same words that appeared in episode 17.
Fine, then just delete it then.
No, I'm not deleting it. It's a walk down memory lane. But anyway, this is all to do with J-Lo. Now, even just to say J-Lo actress, there might be people who dispute if she's actually even worthy of the title of an actress.
I mean, you could say, is she worthy of the title of singer? Now, not being shady, it's only because she had established herself as an actress before singing.
Yeah, it's funny. So we did a little bit of, like, reconstruction, primarily through Wikipedia. But if you had asked me, I would have said, okay, well, J-Lo probably started as a singer. Or if anything, she started as an actress who was also a singer, because I always knew that her big breakthrough role was in Selena, which is a musical biopic, yeah, where she plays the deceased singer.
Selena.
But the thing is, what we learned was that she actually didn't do the singing in the film Selena. It was, they used Selena's own vocal tracks and she lip-synced.
Oh, and, right.
Yeah, but J-Lo had always been in musical theater and stuff, and she then started to establish herself as an actress, and it was only a few years or more into her movie career that she had her debut pop album. And I was scratching my head and thinking, like, I can't think of another career trajectory that goes in that direction of, like, established movie star becomes singer, and the singing is super popular.
Yeah, okay, that last part negates what I was going to say.
Right, well, like, Kate Winslet has even had a singing career. Yeah, but ScarJo has had a singing career.
But they have been, like, side projects. I was going to say Lindsay Lohan, who actually, at one point in the early 2000s, was establishing herself as a pop singer. Like, she sang live and stuff, you know? And everyone forgets that ever happened, thank God.
Well, I mean, sadly, Lindsay Lohan is not successful, sadly, in anything right now.
She has a nightclub in Athens, darling. Do you?
She also has the distinction of being the person who is most consistently defending Harvey Weinstein. Yeah. So, whether you consider that success.
Do you know what is a success? Her amazing new accent.
She has really forged new territories in strange intercontinental accents. But to get back to J-Lo, so I was shocked to learn that Adolescent Sean in Longford, where there is nary a Latino to be seen, no matter how many of them might be running around Dublin, there are none in Longford, yeah?
There are plenty of Brazilians in Roscommon.
Next county over?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, with whiffs of Brazilians in the air, 13 or 14-year-old Sean owned how many J-Lo albums?
I had 3 J-Lo albums.
Okay, can you talk us through the circumstances that led you to purchase those albums?
Well, actually, they were all gifts, but that's neither here nor there.
From whom?
From relatives, friends. I requested the albums, so they got them for me. I know exactly why I was into Jennifer Lopez. I was moving into what I would consider to be contemporary adult pop, you know what I mean? And so On the Six never really did anything for me, so I didn't own that one. But the album called Gold, which had I'm Real and Play, that was a good song. That was the first one I had.
Let it be known, I've never heard of either of those songs.
Okay, they're really good songs.
I believe it.
But when you haven't heard of a song, that doesn't mean it hasn't been popular.
It just means it hasn't been covered by Patti LuPone.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so I had that album, and then I had the remix album J to the L-O, which featured I'm Real, I believe. Did I say I'm Real? No.
Sorry, I was just getting distracted by the idea of J-Lo appearing in a revival of War Paint, possibly with Britney Spears. But anyway, carry on.
All right. And then the last one I had, which I never listened to the full way through, which signaled the end of my interest in her, was that dreadful album she had with the Dear Ben song on it.
Yeah, explain to those of us who
Dear Ben is.
We've you know, erased Bennifer from our memories.
I mean, if you tell me any song that involves the name Ben, I just assume you're singing about a rat, you know? You know Ben?
I don't know what this is.
It's a Michael Jackson song. Ben, the two of us. And then there's high notes that I can't reach. Beautiful song by Michael Jackson. It's about a rat, yeah. It was from the movie Ben, but the kind of horror film about the rat.
Wow.
No? And then there was Willard, which came later, like 20 years later. No?
No.
So after this is over, maybe actually on the outro we'll play this song, the beautiful song Ben, which is an ode to a rat, okay?
We both found what we were looking for. With the friend to come my own, I'll never be alone.
Now, I would have been fine with that on the Jennifer Lopez album, but actually it was Ben Affleck who she was singing to.
A rat of another stripe.
Oh, you should never ever sing about the person you're dating, ever. It's just going to cause you embarrassment later on.
No tattoos either. Winona forever. So we've established that you got a bunch of J-Lo albums, you asked for them, you liked the songs, except for the Ben one. But my question is, what is it about the J-Lo persona as a musician that you were responding to? Because, like, I could understand how, like, a Puerto Rican gay boy in the Bronx, or a Puerto Rican girl in the Bronx, or anybody in the Bronx, to be honest, for that matter, could see J-Lo with her kind of rags-to-riches story, like, as aspirational. I could see how a straight guy might be lusting after her
butt.
Her posterior. Yeah. But what is it that you saw in J-Lo?
Well, baby, I think you're trying to make it a bit more complex than it actually is, okay? So when you're from a small country in a small town and you look at America, it's not a matter of a delineation of, like, this is a Latino person, this is a country star, this is a black rapper, okay? To me, at that age, she was just an American singer, North American singer.
Faith Hill, J-Lo, Tammy Wynette, they were all part of a continuum.
You're probably not going to believe me, but yeah, they're just American singers.
Thinking back on this now and thinking on J-Lo as a public entity, her music, her acting, her perfume, her brands, her fashion, how do you now think of J-Lo? I have to say, like, we decided to feature her on this series, and I think having just watched three of her films, we have both come away with a newfound appreciation for this woman's success.
That's for sure. Although I think when we went through her filmography, it kind of, for all intents and purposes, stops at a certain point.
She seemed to have a lot more focus on her film career at a certain point. It's not that she's out of the public eye. She's doing concert appearances for, like, Kazakh, you know, warlords, isn't she? Wasn't she involved in one of those ones where, like, a command birthday performance for someone?
Yeah,
sort of
I believe
dubious?
It was someone like Uzbekistan or somewhere. And her and Janet Jackson are, you know, repeat offenders for that kind of nonsense.
Where's Bob Mueller? Bob Mueller. But so she's doing all that. She's, you know, getting her slush fund. She's violating the Foreign Agents Act or whatever she's doing. She's selling perfume. She's selling out concert venues. She's not focused so much on making movies. Is that a loss? Do we think that Jennifer Lopez is an important cinematic icon or was?
Again, if you look at her filmography, in the early days, the collection of projects that she's done are varied and interesting.
They're sort of indie kind of...
Yeah, for want of a better word, they are indie bits. And then it seems to be a point where she says, no, forget the indie stuff, I'm only in it for the money.
With a lot of people, I would begrudge them that. I would say, oh, look, you know, she began working in indie dramas by Latino artists and working with people like Steven Soderbergh, and then she starts making dreadful romantic comedies and terrible movies with Ben Affleck and action films. I mean, it's the kind of thing that I would criticize Nicolas Cage for. And yet somehow, in the scope of Jennifer Lopez, I'm like, more power to her.
Well, that's because it kind of follows this story of the, you know, second generation, I mean, Puerto Rico is part of the United States, but immigrants.
Tell that to Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know what I mean, though? It's like second-generation immigrant family, and there's always that story of them making their millions and making their money, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, she has decided to be commercial, to be a brand, to be an empire, but J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez, has the charisma to back it all up. Yes, she may not be the world's greatest actress, she may not be the world's greatest singer.
She may not have the most interesting songs, either.
No, but she is somehow a personality that I think as an icon, especially for...
it's bonfire night.
There's a lot of J-Lo fans right outside our street. But, I mean, what's it say? If I say icon again, is there going to be another explosion? No. But she is iconic, and there is probably no bigger Latin star from the United States in any capacity, ever.
Yeah, and especially one, no one with the same amount of crossover scope as she has.
She still comes out in the Oscars and the Golden Globes. She probably comes out on the Grammys.
There's no real reason why she should come out on the Oscars or Golden Globes, to be quite honest.
Well, it's just that she has a big fan base. I think she makes a perfect subject for the good, bad, crazy treatment, because her films have been all over the map.
And we had quite a few to choose from, really.
Yeah. So obviously, when it comes to a good film to choose from, we could have done Selena. That might have seemed obvious. But instead, we went with Out of Sight. It's a highly regarded, popular entertainment, a crime caper thriller from auteurist director Steven Soderbergh, that is part of that 90s string of Elmore Leonard adaptations. having seen some of them, maybe not every single one of them, Jackie Brown, Quentin Tarantino's adaptation, which we did last season, is sort of the pinnacle of those, right? It's the film from that subgenre that is probably the biggest masterpiece. But Out of Sight is really well respected by critics and audiences. George Clooney stars in it. J-Lo is his romantic opposite and foil. And I had seen it a long, long time ago. You'd never seen it, had you, Sean?
No, to be honest, I'd even forgotten about it.
Seeing J-Lo, the young J-Lo, in this film, did it give you any new eyes onto her original charisma, her talent, before she kind of became J-Lo the brand?
Yeah, because she's this beautiful woman, which definitely helps. She's not a blonde white woman, that also helps, because it gives her this ability to have a kind of an edginess to the things she's in, with soft edges, I should say, but edginess nonetheless. And you can see that in things like, dare I say, even Anaconda, where she plays the tough hero, The Cell, which we decided not to do, in which she plays a police officer again. And she is sexy, gorgeous, charming. I get the impression that J-Lo, as a person, is not very funny.
Why do you say that?
It's just years of listening to her music, looking at her in music videos, her as an entrepreneur who carefully edits and controls her image, who never has any scandals, really. You know, the only time she's in the
town... Divorces and
yeah,
things like
but,
that.
Yeah, but that's as far as it goes, you know? You never see her drunk, you never see upper skirt, anything like that.
Like, so why does this lead you to believe she's not funny?
Well, what I mean is, I believe she's very, very in control of everything.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, you don't have to be photographed up the skirt to be humorous, but it does help.
But who is she in Out of Sight? Do you want to just quickly outline her character?
So she plays Karen Sisko, who I'm told is something called a federal marshal in a place called Florida. And she is gorgeous, which also helps when you're in the federal office. And she's quite an accomplished cop, but she has a soft spot for criminals, and don't we all, girlfriend?
Yeah, we kind of are introduced to her in this film. She's sitting with an older man played by Dennis Farina. She's dressed in like quite a nice sort of they're out to a nice dinner, and he's giving her a present in like a nicely wrapped box, and you think it's going to be some kind of jewelry or something like that. And then when she opens it up, what's inside?
When she opens it up, it's a gun, and she's like, "Oh, thanks, Dad." And I thought that was really clever, because what it does to us as a viewer is to say, okay, so what you think this is going to be prepared to have it flipped around. That actually was especially clever, because it was kind of saying, shame on you, audience member, for just assuming this older guy was a lascivious lover of this young woman.
Yeah, and also that this woman who is wearing lip gloss and kind of glamorously put together is out to, you know, get some bling
from daddy. From daddy.
The thing about Karen Sisko, as conceived by Elmore Leonard and screenwriter Scott Frank and played by Jennifer Lopez, is like, she is a girly girl in a lot of ways. Like, she wears this Chanel suit, and she's annoyed when her Chanel suit gets, like, completely destroyed during a shootout. But at the same time, she's also totally comfortable wearing, like, a Miami Dolphins football jersey and these butt-hugging athletic shorts.
Well, that makes two of us.
She looks great. And so she's like a girl's girl, a boy's girl. She's a tough-talking cop.
She has her vulnerabilities. She has weaknesses for hard guys. You know, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah, so the interesting backstory of Karen Sisko, which gets referenced a couple of times, is that even though she's a young and quite successful federal agent, there have been rumors and stories circulating around her that her love life is possibly her weakness, right? She had a boyfriend. I don't know if they say he robbed banks, or he was definitely a bit of a criminal. And so the idea, like, all the men around her, they do think she's competent, but they also think that her weakness is her hormones. That if a...
Well, that's just sexist.
Yeah, but there's evidence, right? Because she is good at her job, and she's definitely the best investigative mind in this entire film. But she also gets weak in the knees if the man that she's pursuing...
looks like George Clooney.
Exactly. And let's be honest, Sean, you got a bit weak in the knees when young 1990-whatever George Clooney appeared on screen.
Now, I have no real memory of this, but I'm not saying you're lying.
We did watch this movie a little while ago. It's taken us a while to record the podcast. Honest to goodness, Sean, when George Clooney took off his shirt in this film, you were...
It wasn't
Max Caulfield level of drool, but I did definitely need to get out the Febreze and spray the bed.
But because it stank, is that it?
The hormones were...
They were pungent.
They were pungent hormones in the drool.
Well, actually, no, the reason why I did drool... it's because George Clooney has this gorgeous lean 90s body. You know, he isn't built like a water mattress like all these guys are these days. We watched a trailer for Geely in preparation for this, and even Ben Affleck had this like much skinnier body as compared to what he had in Gone Girl years later. So that's probably why I swooned over George just a little bit.
Like, it's back in the days when leading men were allowed to be fit, athletic, and hunky, but they didn't need to be
jacked.
Yeah,
as hell.
Doing the Atkins diet or whatever it is now, and kind of seeing a personal trainer 3 times a day.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I did actually fall for Clooney there. Clooney really doesn't normally do things for me because Clooney is always Clooney. I'm not attracted to the same thing all the time.
This movie, it is driven by the sexual and personality charisma of these two stars, right? Their drive, their attraction for each other, it fuels the entire plot. It is a good crime caper. It's not quite, perhaps, as rich and soulful as Jackie Brown turns out to be, because that's that kind of late-in-life thing where Pam Grier and Robert Forster just, you sense this kind of whole... life lived and chances taken and regrets. You sense all of that from those two. These two characters have a similar kind of attraction that's across kind of legal barriers, but it's more about the sex and the hormones than it is about emotion.
Yeah, and also because you can tell Steven Soderbergh is crafting a beautiful noirish thriller, and Quentin Tarantino was fanboying all over Pam Grier. Tonally, they are quite different as a consequence. One thing I do love about this picture is how many scenes we get to establish that there's a deep attraction between these two characters. Most notably, when they are locked in trunk of a car together.
Yeah. I'll just quickly recount the plot because it is rather convoluted. Basically, Clooney is a frequent bank robber. Like, he's in and out of jail all the time. I think his name is Jack Foley.
True.
And he has a couple of associates. He has Ving Rhames is his kind of right-hand guy. Steve Zahn is a kind of scraggly white boy stoner weirdo who also gets involved. So they happen to be escaping from prison in this kind of crazy scheme right at the time that Agent Karen Sisko, Jennifer Lopez, happens to be parking her car right outside the federal facility. And so as they're tunneling out of the prison, she, in her Chanel suit, happens to have her gun and is there to, like, try and stop them. So, of course, rather than killing a federal agent, they dump her in the trunk, and she and Clooney ride in the trunk of this car. And what I think is so fun about that scene, it is, it's such a, like, constructed meet-cute, you know, in terms of, like, the rom-com or the caper or whatever, where, like, the federal agent and the criminal are being attracted to each other. And what do they start talking about in the trunk of the car?
Well, they start talking about movies, which is always, for me, a winning formula in any picture.
It's totally meta because they're talking about Bonnie and Clyde and these kind of people who are thrown together in, like, criminal circumstances and 3 Days of the Condor. But the thing that really, like, made me realize that these two are made for each other is when they start talking about Faye Dunaway and Peter Finch in Network, and she's like, yeah, they won the Oscar for that.
Another movie I liked with Faye Dunaway was 3 Days of the Condor.
With Robert Redford when he was young.
Yeah.
You know, I never thought it made sense, though. You know, the way they got together so quick. I mean, romantically.
Well, but if... All right.
Here we go. All right. And I was like, God, anybody who knows that is destined to a relationship.
Yeah, completely agree.
Even though she is nominally trying to apprehend Clooney and foil this plot, at various points along the way, both criminal and pursuer make choices that are clearly driven by their desire to see one another again rather than either get the loot in his case or apprehend the criminal in her case, which makes it quite fun because you're kind of waiting to see, like, when are they actually going to get to kiss, have sex, are they going to end up with one another or not? You know, what's going to happen?
You know, and not only does it establish there's an attraction between the two of them, it also really, you know, messes with us with a very, very steamy, and that's not just because there's a bath involved, dream sequence in which J-Lo goes to the apartment that Jack Foley is supposed to be hiding out in to apprehend him. And instead of just cuffing him while he bathes luxuriously in the bath, she ends up climbing in with him.
Fully clothed.
Fully clothed, getting, you know, wet and wild and soapy and snogging the hell out of him. And then, after about 7 minutes, it's a dream sequence.
It's not fully 7 minutes, but I think that was the time where the Sean drool was maybe at its most voluminous.
Well, what I like about it is that it takes the time to allow these things to happen, because, you know, it's not a film that is pivoting on the heist or the chase or the action as such. They're integral parts to it. But what it pivots on is this attraction between these two characters. And it gives it room for them to stretch their legs, as it were.
I had real respect for both Elmore Leonard and Scott Frank with this adaptation, because you kind of think with this sort of thing, it's going to go one of two ways. They're never, never, never going to get together. Or they're going to get together and she's going to flip sides. But they keep walking this line and constantly sidestepping expectation. It's hilarious because, like, J-Lo is not allowed onto the FBI task force to chase down these escaped criminals because they sort of suspect that she is maybe got the hots for Clooney. So she starts to, like, pursue them almost like as a free agent. Mm. And she follows them to Detroit, up north, where they're basically involved in a elaborate scheme that also involves Don Cheadle and some other people to get some uncut diamonds from financial fraudster Albert Brooks in his, like, creepy villain Albert Brooks mode. Anyway, that's the plot line. But there's this wonderful bit in a Detroit hotel where she's kind of come up there to try and find the criminals, and she's just on her own sitting nursing a bourbon in this hotel, and these kind of douchebag advertising executives start hitting
on
her.
Yeah, who are there for some expo, no doubt.
They say, like, oh, we had a bet of, like, who could come over and guess your line of work. We think, you know, you're some kind of ad exec who's been sent off, you know, representing some brand, little knowing that she's, like, a federal agent who's, like, single-handedly investigating this, like, massive criminal conspiracy.
You know, I love movies that give men the room to be douchebags on screen, just to remind the population at large.
As if the population at large didn't know these days.
Given the given the current climate, everyone's figuring it out.
Well, so she brushes them off, and then in walks Clooney, dressed to the nines. And the movie gives us, as audience members, what we want in films, which is, like, I feel like this is a very Pauline Kael type of thing, you know, kiss, kiss, bang, bang. Like, this is what we want from movies. We want to see attractive people...
Who we like,
exchanging sexual innuendo via cleverly written banter and looking fucking gorgeous and then getting into bed together.
Yeah, it's very old Hollywood, isn't it?
It is. It's like Bogey and Bacall, this level of charisma between them.
I mean, they didn't exactly undress on screen in front of us back in the day.
No, so we get a bit more than that. So they sit down and Clooney walks up, and obviously she's been looking for him. She could cuff him right there and, like, arrest him. Instead, they have this conversation where he's like, "Hi, my name is Gary." And she's like, "I'm Celeste." And they do this sort of role play where they're pretending for one night, what if we weren't a bank robber and a federal agent? What if we were just two people who met in a bar in other circumstances?
You like bourbon?
I love it.
We got that out of the way. Tell me, Celeste, what do you do for a living?
I'm a sales rep, and I came here to call in a customer, but they gave me a hard time because I'm a girl.
Is that how you think of yourself?
As a sales rep?
As a girl.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with it.
I like your hair. I like your outfit.
But actually, this is my second favorite outfit. I had a first favorite, but it got ruined and I had to get rid of it.
You did?
It smelled.
Really? Having it clean didn't help?
No. So tell me, Gary, what do you do for a living?
How far do you want to go with this?
Not yet. Don't say anything yet.
I don't think it works for somebody else. You know, Gary and Celeste, what do they know about anything?
Well, this is your game I've never played before.
It's not a game. It's not something you play.
It's quite fun, because you don't sort of know where it's going. The brilliant editing by Anne V. Coates, who recently won an honorary Oscar.
She did the editing for Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah, so there's this brilliant stuff where they're having this conversation, and then we're cutting ahead to them, you know, undressing and getting into bed together and getting it on. And of course, we've seen them do it already in fantasy. And now we're thinking, is this real? And it is real. So they do spend this night of passion in the hotel where they sleep together. Then they basically realize, yeah, we had our thing, we had our fling, and now we're going back to our two roles on opposite ends of the law. And I thought that was just a great way to do this plot. It's like, give us the thing that we want, and then let's get back to the crime.
Yeah, I love that. It was very, very clever.
Can we just whiz through some of the other elements of the movie that we enjoyed? So first of all, in terms of our loving of actresses, there are two brilliant,
oh, yeah,
brilliant other actresses who appear in quite small roles.
Yeah, talk about Easter eggs. We have Catherine Keener playing Dumb, which she plays acerbic and kind of bitchy.
Yeah. She's Clooney's ex-wife.
Yeah, she's very funny. She gets a few very funny lines and a really funny scene with J-Lo in which she's totally the fall guy.
She's some sort of like slutty woman who's worked as like a magician's assistant or something.
Yeah, basically, you know, she's a hustler, job-wise. And then we also get Academy Award winner Viola Davis.
In a kind of amazing role where J-Lo shows up in Detroit trying to track down Don Cheadle's thuggish hitman guy, who's this like jacked sort of boxer type guy who's really threatening. And his girlfriend is Viola Davis.
Yeah, and their dog is called Tuffy.
And so in walks sexy Latina agent Jennifer Lopez.
In a gorgeous jacket.
Yeah, looking super chic in leather. And there's this like fascinating little scene where Jennifer is looking at Viola and just being like, she's trying to extract information, yeah, about what's going on in terms of Don Cheadle's criminal enterprise. But she's looking at Viola Davis and just thinking, this poor woman is, you know, being probably exploited and abused by this guy. And then this guy, the hitman guy, starts giving the most dreadful sexual come-ons to Jennifer Lopez about Tuffy the dog and all.
Yeah.
Every little bitch wants a bone and all this kind of stuff.
You're a fighter.
How you know that?
I can tell.
Yeah, I was. Till I got my retina detached 2 times.
Would you fight about middleweight?
Oh, light, super middleweight. That's my body developed. But you go about what, bantam?
Flyweight.
Nigga, what? You know your divisions, huh? But you like the fights? You like the rough stuff? Yeah, I bet you do.
I gotta go, Kenneth. Maybe we'll see each other again sometime.
No, we gonna tussle first. Damn it! What the fuck was that?
You wanted to tussle. We tussled.
She whacks him. Yeah. So that's the thing. Like, J-Lo is sexy. She has the banter. And she also has the action hero chops in this film. She's kind of amazing.
Yeah, well, let's be honest. It's the role that gives her this.
Yeah.
She just makes it her own.
But not everyone could do all of that.
No, and this is exactly from my point earlier, is that Jennifer Lopez is a person with soft edges.
Yeah, she's a girly girl who's also tough,
yeah,
which I think is amazing.
And it's like both sides are completely her.
Should we just whiz through the ending? Because there's a kind of extended, sort of brilliant sequence that gets really violent.
Yeah,
where
I love a film that gets super violent.
I know you do.
Yeah.
So they show up at Albert Brooks's house. The criminals show up first, and then Jennifer Lopez trails after them. Don Cheadle and his henchmen are kind of ready to like wreak total havoc in order to find the uncut diamond. So they're ready to sort of rape and kill
Whomever, really.
Yeah, whomever. Albert Brooks and his mistress. It gets really, really tense.
This is actually a part of the film that you kind of have to remind yourself is coming, because we get so involved in the relationship part that when it suddenly becomes a thriller again, it almost, you know, turns the volume up to remind you, yes, it's a thriller, pay attention. So when the threat of rape and the kidnapping and the quite graphic, you know, scenes of body parts being, you know, blown open and things, you're kind of like, oh yeah, okay, I know what kind of movie this is again.
Well, it's also, there's these complicated moral dynamics where Cheadle is ready to kill anyone. Clooney wants the loot, but he is not a cold-blooded killer the way Cheadle is. So they're nominally together, but as Cheadle starts pushing the violence, Clooney is like, no, I've got to go back in there. I've got to save these people. And meanwhile, J-Lo is wanting to foil the crime and get these guys arrested.
And actually, she doesn't want to kill Jack Foley, does she?
No. So it ends up, there's kind of all this like triangulation of the shooting, and Don Cheadle and his henchmen end up dying. Karen Sisko has to shoot Clooney in the leg to like incapacitate him. And then the question becomes, how is this all going to end? This like throbbing, you know, charismatic romance that's gone on between these two the whole time. And what happens in the final scene?
She cuffs them, she puts them in a van, and she drives it to jail.
Along with Samuel L. Jackson,
along
who just
Samuel
pops up.
Along with Samuel Jackson, yeah. We should also say that Michael Keaton pops up in this film as his character from Jackie Brown. So possibly it's the same universe, except Samuel L. Jackson obviously cannot be the same character he was in Jackie Brown because Odell was killed.
Unless this is somehow before the action of Jackie Brown. He definitely doesn't have the name Odell.
No, and he doesn't have that little ratty rat's tail. You know, that little
yeah,
chin.
Goatee.
Ugh,
yeah.
That's gross.
So I guess if we were more familiar with the Elmore Leonard universe, maybe we would understand how all these things are interlinked. But it is a kind of fun meta nod in a movie that has lots of meta nods. But I think what I loved from this is like, yeah, sure, if they had alternative lives, Karen and Jack could perhaps get together, shtup some more, make babies, and get hitched. But they're not going to do that. He's going to go back into jail and probably cycle through more crime, and she's going to go off and, you know, rise up in the ranks of the FBI or the federal marshals.
Do you think this is a perfect film?
It's a really fun, really enjoyable crime caper. I think the thing about it is that it makes me a little bit sad. I think J-Lo is so good in this movie. And when you think about the fact of, like, what Soderbergh could do, for instance, for Julia Roberts, mm-hmm. when he, like, gave her the role of her lifetime in Erin Brockovich.
Which is still such a great film and such a great role.
And he is good sometimes with, like, kick-ass female heroines. I forget what the name of that movie was where he took that, like, female martial arts expert woman and turned her into an action hero. But, like, Soderbergh does really interesting projects. And
is that Boxing Helena?
Kickboxing Helena. No. The thing is, like, had J-Lo continued down the route of doing these kind of really well-crafted movies where she had lots of different levels to play, I think her career could have gone in a different direction where she could have been allowed to flex some of her different acting muscles.
You know, the thing is, though, I have a feeling that is largely down to decisions that Jennifer Lopez made by herself. Not so much in terms of the things that she was offered, but in terms of where she wanted to bring her career.
Yeah, although did she make them by herself, or did she make them in the 18-month delusional experience that was her relationship with Ben Affleck?
Okay, well, I mean, Jersey Girl and Gigli, I'm putting the blame squarely upon her.
Can we just say, like, ladies, don't date Ben Affleck.
No, don't. He does nothing for your career.
Has anyone ever benefited from dating Ben Affleck, except possibly Matt Damon?
He is a movie killer.
I mean, he's not just a movie killer, but he's like a kind of career diversion for all these sorts of people like Gwyneth and Jennifer Lopez. And poor Jennifer Garner, who honestly deserves much better. I mean, I know they had a longer marriage.
I mean, when Dallas Buyers Club is the jewel in your crown, you know, you gotta put on a different crown.
Don't forget Alias. But, yeah. Anyway, this is not about Ben. This is about Jennifer. I am happy that she is a mega-rich, mega-successful, and is a role model for Latin girls the world over, but I do kind of wonder what the alternative universe is like where J-Lo would get to play more complex women and kind of be a tough, vulnerable hero that we need in our times. Maybe she still has that role in her, does she?
You know what? She did a great job as Karen Sisko. I'm interested to see her as Karen Silkwood. You know what I mean?
Sadly, darling,
It's set in New Mexico.
Silkwood dies at the end of the movie.
And this is a remake. Okay, set in New Mexico.
So she's investigating nuclear waste again?
You know, but this time there's a digital element.
Maybe this could be the, like, Russian hacking drama where she's, like, going to Moscow and, like, tracking down, you know...
Via Albuquerque.
What is the New Mexico part of it?
Because it has to border Mexico.
Okay. I think this maybe needs a few more passes in the script development, but I can see there's a rough potential there. We dived further into Jennifer Lopez's filmography with films that really aren't good. They're certainly nowhere near as good as Out of Sight, but I have to say, in all three of these movies that we watched, Jennifer Lopez is not the same in any of them. Am I right?
For sure correct.
Yeah. In this next movie, she is paired not with a hunky movie star, but with a grande dame of legendary proportions.
Yes. I'm so excited. I can't believe I finally got the opportunity to legitimately watch this film. Only under slight duress. I finally got to see the film about the ultimate Bridezilla, and it's not J-Lo.
So you might already have guessed what the next installment in the trilogy is going to be. If you want to get some more hints, follow us at Broad Appeal Pod on Twitter, where we'll be giving you some teases. You can find me at B.A. Mullen Speaks.
And yes, I am at Sean McGovern X. We'll be returning with a film that sees J-Lo in a totally new shade of champagne or magnolia or off-white, and a grande dame returning to the screen with monstrous proportions. You figure it out.